Now, to begin the public portion, I wanted to first find out if the members, if the board members have any change in the order of business. Okay, seeing none, the agenda as set forth is in play. And next, we're going to move to the approval of the minutes for the board meeting on March 4th, 2008. And before we do that, I wanted to bring up a point of order. There has been some discussion about the minutes themselves in terms of what they contain. And in my spare time, I looked at the Robert's Rules of Orders, newly revised. And in summation, it says that unless the minutes are being used for public records, such as a congressional meeting, that the minutes should only contain what was done at the meeting and not was said at the meeting by its members. So I want to present that to the board tonight in reference to the concern about how things are characterized or written to determine if we can agree upon a means of recording the minutes so everyone is satisfied, understanding that Robert's Rules of Order said for our type of public meeting, the minutes only require that what is done or what motions are passed or what happens at the meeting are reported, not comments by members. So if we want to have some kind of hybrid of that, then we should discuss it and agree to it, or we should just go along with what Robert's Rules of Order said in terms of minutes. So I'll open that up to the board for any comments.
I would support that. We have a transcript of the meeting. The transcript of the meeting is the coverage from AGP, I believe. Is that not correct, Kim? And do we also have an audio recording as well, or is it
By AGP, they provide an audio and a video. Those are only retained for 90 days.
Okay.
Our legal advice in the past when we've had these kinds of discussions was that those electronic versions should only be retained for a brief period of time because they're intended to be available as a resource to confirm that the written minutes are accurate. Mm-hmm. And not any longer than necessary to do that. And if they were retained for a longer period of time, they would be deemed public record and have to be retained forever.
And he gives a long speech to all of the deans there, and he ends up with all of them sitting on him, taking him to the emergency room because he has this disability where, and even though he's so intelligent and articulate in his brain, what comes out is like inhuman, garbled sounds. And sometimes I think that, you know, the point I'm trying to make is completely not expressed well. I feel sort of like that character. So I would just assume not have it characterized sometimes what I've tried to say. Instead of trying to clear up, no, that wasn't what I meant. An example is just this week, which is partly why this came up. And I think Kim does such a superb job of these extensive minutes, which are beautifully done. But this one case where it said that I was trying to make the point that Sabrina was in the first class where instrumental music was dropped in the school day, so she dropped out, whereas the boys had that opportunity and played all through high school and still play. So it was a determining factor in her whole musical life, and that didn't come through in the minutes. So it just shows it's so hard to communicate. So this way, if we just had, you know, what's in the advanced agenda and what we voted on, we wouldn't have to worry about that.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments, Mr. Millar?
Well, I have brought up the distinction on a number of occasions that we do action minutes. And I think this, if we focus on action minutes, we'll spend a lot less time making nuanced changes to the minutes.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Okay. And Mark?
Yes, slightly further in Robert's Rules of Order, it does allow for, and I think rightly allows for, when there's a guest speaker, or in our case, I think maybe during study sessions, for more comments to be recorded, because they're, it's more appropriate. And so if we're going to do that, I would suggest that we continue with that concept, and it's in Robert's Rules of Order.
Well, then why don't we, if everybody's okay, just reflect that the rules state that the minutes will contain what was done at the meeting and not necessarily what was said at the meeting unless it's necessary to explain what occurred as to the factual happening without any worry about the actual content.
If I may, I'm comfortable with that, but I've noticed a lot of rules, Robert's Rules, being thrown around in the last few weeks, and Robert's Rules is merely a guide to the board. The board has its own...
Wait a second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Should I just not bother to change the words? I think that would... Or is that okay to do that on that last time? I would rather have it say, Mrs. Dickinson explained that Sabrina was actually in the first class where music instruction was moved to after school, so she dropped out right away. The boys, however, were in band all through high school and still play. This shows that early years may make the difference between playing music lifelong or not.
Okay. So, taking into consideration the amendment proposed by Adrian, would you amend your motion to include that so the public record that's being recorded would include that?
And I'd ask for a vote on the amendment.
Okay. So we now have a vote on the amendment to amend the minutes of the March 4th, 2008 meeting. Do we have a second to amend? Now we have to have a second to that motion.
Right.
And that'll take vote of precedence over the main motion. So there has to be a second to consider that.
Okay.
Hearing none, then it dies for lack of a second. So we go back to the main motion, Mr. Buckman, for the minutes to be approved as is, and for Mr. Unger, who seconds it. Any other discussion? None. All in favor? Aye. Opposed?
No.
Five.
I am abstaining as well.
So it's 4, 1 no, and 2 abstentions by Mr. Millar and Ms. Rogers. At the time the agenda was prepared, there was no correspondence, so there's nothing to share. And now is an opportunity for public comment next on the agenda, and I have a request by Carrie Wagner. Now, you can speak either now or you can wait for the item when it comes up on the agenda number 4, so that's your choice. Okay, thank you. Any other members of the public that wish to address the board at this time? Please come forward, and if you could state your name, and then there's a 3-minute time period.
I'm going to talk really fast because I want to talk about 2 items. My name is Maria Kelly. I'm the PTA co-president at Pacheco Elementary School. My first item, I'm here tonight to talk about a film that the Pacheco PTA and Hope Dance Film is sponsoring. And I'm just here to let you know about it, to invite you to come if you're interested. It's called Two Angry Moms, and what it's about is about it's a documentary about two mothers and afterwards. So just to let you know what we're up to.
When?
Oh, I apologize. April 14th at 6:30 p.m. The film is 1 hour. And it should be really interesting. We'll get a nice wide draw from the community. It'll be nice to be reaching out to the broader community versus just that parent and PTA group, and it fits under your student wellness policy and guidelines, so I think it's very appropriate to be here discussing it. The second item I wish to address is item number 4. I also live in Los Osos. I participated in the Arts and Science Fair at Baywood Elementary on Saturday, and it was absolutely wonderful. They have such a great program there. The principal there is phenomenal. The teachers are great. The two water purveyors, Golden State Water and the CSD, were there, as well as the county, the stormwater program. And when I read through the staff report, one of the things that struck me about the discussion around drilling your own wells is there was no discussion around conservation. Water conservation is the first attack when looking at budgets and costs. It's not even addressed. It's not even discussed. There's a cost surrounding the drilling of new wells. There's the cost that it will decrease your costs and be diverted directly to educational programs, which I kind of question a little bit when is building maintenance ever diverted directly back to educational. But it just struck me that there was no discussion about conservation. And if we're really going to be talking about training our children and talking about the future, it's not status quo. You don't just get to keep doing what you're doing. It's really important to start looking at the bigger picture. 30 years ago, that upper aquifer that you're talking about tapping into was in overdraft due to solo pumping of the upper aquifer until it was shut down due to high nitrates. Second, the pumping patterns have changed that. So they over now they're over pumping the lower, so now we're overdrafting the lower. But the reality is that the purveyors do intend to use that aquifer for drinking water, and Golden State already does. They blend it because of the high nitrate content and other issues in certain wells. They do blend that surface water. I'm almost done. Anyway, so those are my thoughts. Conservation, and I feel like the staff report is a little lacking in some of the discussion that needs to be have around that. And if the money, if it's really just about the money and saying we get to have free irrigation and just keep doing what we're doing, I really question the long-term vision of that. And do you really want to continue to be an 80% exterior water user in our schools? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who would like to address the board?
Brought some actual numbers, class sizes for the edification of the board, so you can look at those actual class sizes and see what they're like. Especially problematic are the combo classes. PE teachers tell me that those are going to be very difficult to go ahead and meet the standards, the new standards coming up, especially in the grades 4 through 6. The second item just came to, and I'm just going to speak off the top of my head, but you were referring to Robert's Rules of Order and also about the minutes, and I'd just like to remind the board that most teachers can't be here at the board meetings. It's school nights, and they're grading papers and doing lesson plans, and one of the key communications is this blue record. So they're at every site, and at our school they're in the library and also in the staff lounge, and I see teachers reading these, so I kind of agree with Mr. Millar that you shouldn't allow the Robert Rules to handcuff you in that. I like the idea of the hybrid. I like the way the minutes are right now. At your disposal you have Kim Holmes, so she's doing a great job with the recording. Her summaries are accurate and outstanding. So I just think it's a great communication piece. A lot of teachers don't have access to the public access station. So when do they ever get to see what the board is saying and what the board's thinking? And this gives us a little look into what's going on at every board meeting. And I'd hope I know it's probably a little bit more work, but I hope that you try and retain that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. Any other comments to the board before we go into the rest of the agenda?
May I just mention that you can listen to audio on the website for AGP Video and Channel 21 Public Access, and I've used that myself a couple of times when I've missed meetings.
Thank you.
Can I ask Catherine? A question? I actually hadn't considered that. I didn't think anyone read these, actually, except us. That's a really valid point that he raises about the teachers needing this information. Can we put it to another vote?
I think... You know, I thought the way we left it, and I may be wrong, was that adjustments would be made to the actual...
Why we're voting the way we're voting. Maybe, and so I personally would reconsider.
Well, I know that in the minutes you won't see that all the time. There'll be just comments that appear to be relevant, too. So I, at the end of the day, if everybody wants to, we can bring this up as an agenda item and talk about what the minutes we feel are important, what they should look like, and what they aren't going to be. Because my only concern was that the minutes were being treated as a verbatim record of what was said, and changes were being made in certain portions, and that's really not the purpose of those. So Chris has a comment.
I would support you in bringing it back as, if we have an interest in bringing it back as an agenda item. And I think Mr. Buckman might have some comments about ways to communicate what the board does with the public, and so perhaps I'm feeling like too much discussion about this non-agendized item could be a problem.
So maybe if everybody's comfortable, we can talk about it at the advance agenda towards the end of the meeting. Okay, thank you. And the music, by the way, is enjoyable as the background.
I can put my microphone by the door.
We're going to move on to reports next, and it would be administrators, board members, and any school staff that wish to report any issues related to the district's business. Mark?
Being a school board member just keeps getting more and more interesting. I was over by the Vets Hall last week and noticed a little green sign hanging on the door that said truancy, and there was an arrow pointing into the building. So I followed the little green signs and actually got to sit in on one of the county truancy hearings. I'm not sure it was the SARB hearings, not having anything else to do in my life. And so it was very interesting to see the way that it was handled and the gentleness and the ability to work with the parents, and I was very impressed. I also would like to follow up on, at the last meeting, Chris and I announced that we had attended the formation of the San Luis Obispo Education Coalition, and there will be a website that will be posted very soon that will allow residents to click and send messages to their legislators. And the URL is saveslowschools.org. So every once in a while, start trying that and take a look.
To share them with the public. The first is the continuing budget debacle in Sacramento is the best way I can put it, and I know that Mr. Miller is going to be talking about that. The governor has not backed off of his proposal to slash school budgets. March 15th has come and gone, and I believe that many of the school districts in our county have laid off employees. We're not even sure what next year is going to bring, and I would encourage and ask everyone to contact their local legislators. That would be Abel Maldonado and Sam Blakesley, and tell them that you have some very serious concerns about the governor's proposed budget and what it would do to our children. The second thing, we had a discussion on some revisions to the Prop 39 rules. Prop 39 is, in addition to changing the way that bond issues can be passed in California, also addresses charter school facilities. And there was an administrative ruling saying that charter schools, when established from non-district charter schools, have the absolute right to the same facilities that schools are entitled to, and that not only includes classrooms, but it includes computers, copiers, software, even vehicles. It could be quite devastating for schools, especially schools that are facing serious financial crises, when they're talking about, fortunately we're not, but other school districts will be talking about closing schools. Those schools might have to be offered up to charter schools, and so the savings that schools could get when their enrollment is declining would be offset by their requirement to support charter schools. And the last thing that does potentially affect us, although we, I believe, are 93rd on the Program Improvement 3 list with the highest score in all of California, Program Improvement Schools, which were identified by I believe it was AYP, is that not correct, or is it? Yeah. Those school districts will be forced now to look toward getting what are called district assistance intervention teams. The district assistance intervention teams, once chosen, will be making recommendations for school districts that could be binding on school districts. The school districts will be paying for those, and if those particular suggestions or requirements years ago, and it was really fun, and they made some good money, and thanks to Mrs. Hoppe for helping put it on, really just a really fun event. So thank you.
Mr. Thanks, President.
Yeah, Mr. Buckman.
I'm sorry, if I could add one more piece.
Certainly.
I had the pleasure of working with retired teacher Kathy Settle, who is working to put together a panel on homelessness among children in San Luis Obispo County. It will be May 19th at 6:30 p.m. out at the San Luis Obispo County Office of Education. Right now, her research is showing that there are approximately 800 children in the county every single night that are homeless, and so she's putting together a panel discussion on it.
Okay. Adrian, then Dr. Valentine.
We're required by No Child Left Behind to have military recruiters on high school campuses, and this last weekend was an event called Winter Soldier, which was sponsored by Iraq Veterans Against the War near Washington, D.C., at the Labor University in Maryland. I can't remember the name of the town. And it was not broadcast at all on mainstream media or any of the major newspapers. The Washington Post, I apparently had it on in the local section, a small article. But
BBC World News.
Thank goodness. So there was one way on Charter you could get it. Otherwise, you had to watch Dish, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, and they had live running coverage of these hearings, which lasted for 3 days. Of veterans were invited from Iraq and Afghanistan, and these young guys and women came and just talked about their experiences, which were amazingly harrowing. And my husband copied them. We have 8 discs here. If any social studies teachers want to borrow them, I can burn them for you, or English teachers who want some writing prompts. But it seems unfortunate that the voices of the people who've been in war and the actual voices of soldiers are squelched in our society, and yet recruiters have full access to students on our campuses. So I think it's a very important balance in information for public school students. And I encourage you to access these.
Dr. Valentine, then Mr. Millar.
Yeah, last week I had the opportunity to attend the State Board of Education hearing in which they were deliberating the sanctions that the corrective actions actually was the change in term that was created at this meeting, the corrective actions that would befall program improvement school districts. The 97 school districts that are in program improvement, of which San Luis Coastal is one, were divided into 4 basic categories of intervention. At one level, districts who had not met a number of their targets were assigned heavy interventions, which involved essentially county or state-appointed advisory teams to come in and help. There was a group that was assigned moderate interventions, which involved more individually selected advisory teams to come in. Third was light, in which there was a lot more discretion on what kind of teams would come in and take over. And then there was a 4th category, which was called other. And other essentially required school districts in that category to revise their LEA plan, which is the school district academic plan, and demonstrate what we would be doing or what they would be doing to address the particular issue that put them into program improvement. And it was obviously the lightest category of all. We were in that category. Our issue is the achievement of English learners in the area of English language arts, and it's a topic that's near and dear to us. Mr. Unger, I think you're right. We had the highest API among the 97 districts that were in program improvement, but certainly not the highest API in the state. And at any rate, it sort of one of the things that struck me as I was sitting there was that there were school districts on the list that were probably doing better than school districts that were not on the list. There were school districts that were low on the list that perhaps had districts high on the list were doing better than they were, and had to be struck by the kind of arbitrariness of the placement and the sanctions and the corrective actions that were assigned.
Two things, and then we'll see if there's any more. There's a conference being held in San Jose on April 25th to the 27th, and this is just something to share with the rest of the board and with the school community. on English language learners and diverse needs of all children. And it's being presented by the Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California School Boards Association. And we have a study session coming up probably later in the year. I'm not sure what date. But this is something that probably will have material that will be germane to our district also. And then the second thing is, and I'm mentioning this not as a political endorsement, although I do support him, there's a 37-minute speech given today by Barack Obama on the history of race relations in the United States and how it's impacting the election. It's on MSNBC, and irrespective of who you may support or vote for president, it's an amazing speech on where the country has been, where it's going, and what's happening today. So if you have a chance to look at that, it's the whole speech is there. It's really an incredible speech. Whether he wins or not, it's going to be something that people will talk about because of what the content that's in there. And any other? Okay. Moving on, then I think we have the status of the state budget. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. President. In Sacramento is, as Mr. Unger called it, a little bit dysfunctional what's going on at the moment. The debate continues about the state budget, but there are facts emerging that pretty much are without dispute. First and foremost is that the deficit that confronts the state continues to grow. Last month, the prognostication of revenues fell. The actual amounts fell short of the prognostication by almost $3 million. So it's another month of shortfall. When the state did its mid-year cuts, it cut $8 billion from the budget deficit, but there still remains another $8 billion to go, and that's growing every month that we have a revenue shortfall, such as what happened last month. So they continue to have very difficult debates about what to do next. I think that the partisan politics that Democrats and Republicans are engaged in is absolutely destructive in terms of trying to solve a problem that everybody admits exists. The Democrats are engaged in putting out this. We only have one real milestone to look forward to at this time, and I don't anticipate much happening until then. That's the May revise on May 14th. The governor will take in all the latest information available to him. He'll look at his January budget proposals, and based upon the most current information, he'll make some adjustments, perhaps, in what he had speculated and proposed in January. So between now and May, I'm not so sure that much is going to happen, but we will look forward to the May revise as something that perhaps can bring us clarity before we're forced to adopt our budget by June 30th on a platform and basis of information that the state hasn't even been able to adopt its own budget, which will definitely have an impact on us. So between now and May 15th, not a whole lot expected to happen. After May 15th, we can only hope that we're blessed with the ability to make good guesses about the state's intentions and put together a budget by June 30th that takes into account a lot of unknowns, and we won't be too far off, we can only hope.
Mr. Buckman?
While I don't disagree with Mr. Miller that there's probably going to be a slogan of the week and a lot is happening up in Sacramento, I think it's imperative that the public let their legislators, and especially between now and the May revise, let the governor know what you think. He has slowly come from a no new revenue to possibility of cutting loopholes, and I think that the governor could be swayed. So I'm not quite as pessimistic.
Dr. Valentine?
I had an opportunity last Friday actually to participate in meetings both with Senator Maldonado and with Assemblyman Blakesley and get to share, first of all, an education perspective on the budget and also to have our representatives share their perspectives with us. Senator Maldonado indicated that he would not be supportive of a budget that included education cuts, and of course we've seen Senator Maldonado break ranks with the Republicans in the past, particularly on budget issues, and it's something that we have phoned our appreciation for. Assemblyman Blakeslee was very courteous and cordial in listening to our positions. Not sure exactly where that's going to lead, but I think it's...
For approval, the criteria upon which the California Department of Education approves a charter school, and the state requires that these criteria be reviewed and renewed every 5 years by the school district which initially granted the charter. There's 15 items of criteria developed, and Bellevue Santa Fe has gone through its approval process, and its board has adopted the 15 criteria, and we bring it to you tonight for discussion and action.
Mr. President, if I may, I'd like to invite Brian Goetz, who is the principal of Bellevue Santa Fe, not as public comment, but just as a kind of co-author of this item, to perhaps come forward and share a thought or two. Yeah.
Certainly, Mr. Goetz. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I should let you know I do have my eye on Russell's car. I'm just kidding. I'm Brian Goetz. I'm the principal of Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School. You got it, Chris. All right. Good job.
I don't think you can have his private car.
Okay. Well, I'm Brian Goetz. I'm the principal of Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School. I'm here tonight representing 146 students, 112 families, 14 staff members, and a couple of rabbits from the school. I just want you to know how appreciative we are of your board and the support we've received from your board. We're here tonight to request a renewal of our charter. It's required every 5 years for a charter school to come before its charter granting agency and get a renewal of the charter, and I think it's wise and I think it's appropriate. I brought for you tonight something you could look at that maybe will give you a sense of our school, and so I brought a yearbook for each of you.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
We always enjoy coming out to Bellevue.
Enjoy having you come out. We're appreciative of you considering the renewal of our charter. I'm deeply grateful for the positive working relationship we have been able to forge between Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School and San Luis Coastal Unified School District. It is an honor to be a part of such an exceptional district. Okay. Or address your concerns or listen to your comments.
Yeah, Dr. Valentine?
Yeah, I'd just like to add that this week, Bellevue Santa Fe is receiving a validation visit for its nomination as a California Distinguished School, and we extend our congratulations to Bellevue for moving that far down the process, and we've got our fingers crossed that they'll have a successful visit and move on to become a California Distinguished School.
And I think Mr. Unger is going to move the motion, but before he does, I was just going to say I think that everyone has heard stories or had parents or children who have benefited from the program like the rest of the district has provided. So I think that we're all also very proud of the work that you're all doing and the support that you're giving the students and the innovation that you bring to that daily curriculum.
Thank you, Mr. Unger. Thank you.
I would move approval of item number three, the Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School renewal.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Ms. Dickinson. Any discussion or other questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
The next agenda item. Item number four is the Los Osos groundwater irrigation project. And Mr. Parker, please. Thank you.
Good evening. I thought it'd be good to start with a little review of how we got to where we are with respect to water in Los Osos. Board Member Roger expressed a concern whenever she found out about the level 3 water emergency declared in Los Osos and asked staff to investigate possible ways that we could assist. And we did a staff report, I think your board will recall, evaluating in both our domestic water usage as well as our irrigation usage, and looked at all the opportunities for conservation. And it became apparent through that study that the opportunities for the domestic usage, which is probably only 20 to 25% of our total water usage, was relatively minor. However, the opportunities presented by the use of upper aquifer non-potable water would seem to have been a real win-win situation for the community of Los Osos' water situation, as well as for the school district. As you know, our schools are, for the most part, the public parks in Los Osos. And as such, they have a great deal of turf. And we keep that turf irrigated both for our educational program as well as for the community's recreation program. In Morro Bay, we save about $190,000 a year by irrigating from well water. At San Luis High School, we save well over $100,000 a year by irrigating with well water and using a well water for our domestic purposes. And at Pacific Beach, we save probably over $30,000 or $40,000 a year by irrigating with well water. Now, some of these things have been going on for 15, 20 years almost, Morro Bay more recently, but San Luis High was done in, I think, 1989 or 88. So these are general fund dollars that we're saving. These are dollars that would have to be spent for utilities that don't have to be spent and are then contained in the budget for whatever purposes the board chooses to use them for in our normal budgeting process. We've had meetings with the purveyors in Los Osos. They have asked us not to put in our wells. I know the board's aware of correspondence from their attorney and from our attorney. Water rates are going to be going up in Los Osos. Water will be costing us more. We have an opportunity to try and approach groundwater for irrigation if the board so chooses, or we will be just, we'll maintain the status quo and use the potable water supply for our irrigation. Any questions that I can help?
Mr. Unger?
So right now, Brad, the water that we're using to irrigate, as I understand it, there are two aquifers in Los Osos. There's an upper aquifer and a lower aquifer. The water that we're purchasing from the purveyors is right now from the lower aquifer, which is that the one that's an overdraft?
The lower aquifer is in overdraft. The entire basin is in overdraft in total. There are some upper aquifer wells that are used by the purveyors in certain areas and blended with the lower aquifer. It's somewhat dependent upon where you extract, whether or not the water is of a suitable quality in the upper aquifer for use in domestic application.
What's the situation with saltwater intrusion into the lower aquifer in Los Osos?
The numerous reports have determined that they are pulling more water out of the basin than it's recharged with. Consequently, seawater moves into the basin from the ocean. So the community has to come up with a plan that reduces the total demand on the basin and allows it to recharge from natural freshwater sources rather than having saltwater intrude from the ocean.
Catherine?
Mr. Parker, I...
Approximately three-year payback.
And Brad, is the water that's being used at the middle school now in Los Osos coming from the lower aquifer being pumped?
It's coming from the lower, and to the extent that they blend any upper aquifer waters any place in their system, there may be some upper aquifer water being used as well. I can't say it's all 100% lower aquifer water, but it's primarily lower aquifer water.
So the draw from the lower aquifer is causing the problem that Mr. Unger mentioned about the salt water intrusion into that basin?
Yes.
So the idea, if we do have this occur, would be that the use of the upper aquifer, if there's water available, would reduce or negate the draw on the lower aquifer, and the saltwater intrusion would be affected positively by that?
Yes, and that's an immediate effect. As soon as we begin to produce from the upper aquifer, then we would stop being supplied water, potable drinking water, from the community's supply. The upper aquifer now is judged to spill, and by that I mean it actually just spills out into the ocean rather than finding its way into the lower aquifer. Some very small amount finds its way into the lower aquifer, but it overflows.
So right now we're using potable or drinkable water to on the fields.
That's right.
And we wouldn't do that if there was a well.
That's correct.
Okay. I think we had
Could I clarify something?
Sure.
You said that we would be that we would stop using potable water. I'm assuming that you're talking about for irrigation, not for the purposes of drinking water at the school.
Is that correct?
So the drinking water at the school and the water used for whatever dishes and things like that would remain part of the current domestic water system?
That's correct. And
okay.
That's about 20-25% of the total usage.
Thank you.
Marilyn?
Thank you. This is an issue that I brought up, and I am very concerned about it, as I think are many people who live in Los Osos, and those who are unaware of it, I hope will try to familiarize themselves. As a family, we're able to do certain things. As a family, given the problem, we've taken out our lawn. We use the recharge water from our reverse osmosis unit to irrigate plants in the front yard. We've taken a number of steps, and as families we can do those things. But as a school district, I agree that our playing fields are really widely used by the community. Here of water, and I think that we've come up with a very viable win-win solution whereby we will be able to continue to irrigate our school properties, but not with potable drinking water that is at such in such great demand and is creating such a problem for us out there. So for my part anyway, I think this is really I'm still excited about this possible solution.
I had a question before we go to the public comment. Brad, under the recommendation on page 4.2, it says proceed with well drilling. Would it be more accurate to call that a test well drilling? Because don't we have to first determine what the availability is of water upon the upper aquifer at the school site?
Especially at Los Osos Middle School. The other schools are much more established that there is sufficient upper aquifer groundwater. At Los Osos Middle School, we're sort of on the edge of that basin, and we're anticipating that we may need to put in two or three wells spaced out in order to get the necessary water production at that school. And there's a possibility that we won't find enough upper aquifer water, and we do not have intentions of drilling down into the lower aquifer at that site.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions for Mr. Parker, and then we'll open it up to public comment? Seeing none. Thank you very much, Brad, for your presentation always. I believe we have at least one speaker. There may be more, but the first is Carrie Wagner, please. Thank you. It's Carrie?
Carrie, yes.
Okay.
Good evening, Mr. President, staff, members of the public. My name is Carrie Wagner. I'm an engineer with Wallace Group, and I'm here tonight representing the Los Osos Community Services District. First, I want to make sure that the board has received the letter that was hand-delivered today, dated March 18, 2008, as well as the letter that was sent November 9, 2007. I have a copy of those letters here today, and I'll provide them to your secretary after my presentation. Second, I also want to confirm that tonight you're only authorizing staff to proceed with the test well and not the drilling of the production well, and that the board and the staff members will be completing a full environmental review of the test wells subsequent to the production wells. When the water purveyors have been working over several years, working collaboratively to develop the basin management plan. The purveyors have been investing time and money in groundwater basin models and other resources to establish the best management practices for the upper and lower aquifer. It's difficult to manage a basin with many straws in the aquifer, and this is why the LOCSD, Golden State Water Company, as well as S&T Mutual Water Company have strong reservations about the school district adding additional straws to the upper aquifer, especially since the schools are within the purveyors' water districts. The November 9th as well as the March 18th letters address these reservations and our concerns in greater detail for your review. In addition, LOCSD has been investing money in the development and expansion of their water distribution system, including obtaining a $5 million loan from the California Infrastructure and Economic Development Bank. This money is being spent to develop the water distribution system, one, by installing new wells in the upper aquifer. We're currently in the process of drilling new wells in the upper aquifer that will be used to supply water to all the area, all the users, the customers within LOCSD, including the middle school, and to reduce the impacts of the seawater intrusion. Secondly, they're installing a new booster station, which the booster station is being sized for 3,500 GPM, which is strictly only required for the Los Osos Middle School. That is the only user besides the elementary schools in the boosted zone that require 3,500 GPM. So the district is spending this money for that, and we're increasing fire flow and pressure throughout the distribution system. Within the application to the state, the district is showing that the has to show to the state that the school district is one of their highest users, and with this, the information utilized is to ensure that the district, the LOCSD, is capable of repaying that money, and we use your water usage as that claim to be able to ensure that we can pay that back. And if we don't use that information, we have to spread that money amongst all the rest of the users throughout the district. At this time, I'd thank you for giving me the opportunity to address the board.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wagner, for that information. And I think we do have those letters, and we had those today also, if you want to leave those extra copies. Thank you very much. Are there any other members of the public who may wish to address this issue? Is there any motion on the recommendation? If none, I'll make a motion. I would move that the board vote to ask the superintendent or designee to proceed with add the word test well drilling at the Los Osos Middle School site, and to additionally continue to work and to discuss the issues regarding the water distribution, environmental issues, and cost issues related to the drilling of a test well.
And I'll second that.
There's a second by Ms. Roger. Any questions, comments before we move to a vote? Thank you. Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Next on the agenda is the update by the district, Ms. Rita Delkiskamp, on the response to intervention program that we have at the school. Thank you very much, Rita.
Uh-huh. Yes, per the board's request, Martin Envick and I have prepared an update for you on response to intervention. In your agenda item, you'll see we've provided a little bit of background information, such as the strategic plan objectives related to RTI, and also the committee work of the RTI committee. So we've prepared this presentation, and we also have some school site staff members here to provide some anecdotal information for you as we work through our presentation. So Martin's going to start us off here.
Good evening. Normally I would start off with an apology to the audience for having my back to them, but they are getting my better side, so I apologize to you. Thank you, Rita. That's in focus and everything. Terrific. Well, I'm going to, what I find myself doing a lot lately is practicing my reading, but that'll keep me to the script at hand. So you guys can flip along with me if you like, but Rita will have the information in front of us. So again, we're here to talk about response to intervention, or what we refer to as RTI. This was a committee that was started last year. And the reason it was started last year is because federal education law required that before any student is placed in special education, the school must ensure that his or her learning problem is not linked to inadequate instruction. That was something that George Bush moved forward back in 2004, and I'll give you a visual on that in a second here, and are more carefully evaluated for possible referral to special education services.
Martin, if I may,
yes.
Just a quick question on the first page, and
sure.
I apologize for interrupting before you're finished. The information on page 5.1 at the end of the first paragraph says, RTI provides an early intervention system to all children at risk for school failure.
Mm-hmm.
This is referring to special education programs, and I just wanted to clarify for myself when it says all children.
This is a general education function that is meant to address students that are having difficulty learning.
But it's all children.
Correct.
Not necessarily those that qualify for special education.
No, correct.
Programs. Okay.
Correct. Again, I think maybe this will help a little bit, visual here, if I could. You'll see this depicted in many different ways. Sometimes there's circles inside of circles. You see pyramids, whatever visual works for people. We've gone with this one that shows what the continuum of support is for all students. That pyramid represents all students that are receiving education. The tier, it's also kind of colored, if you can kind of see how it shades a little bit, meaning that this is supposed to be something that is fluid. Students aren't put in boxes necessarily. What we see is that there's a universal access to education for all students, which we consider to be about 80% of the population. Then in that next tier of targeted area would address about 15% of the students that are going to need something beyond just the general education instruction. And we'll get into what those approaches may be. And then out of that 15%, so now we're at 95%, there may be about approximately 5% that would require more intense individual attention to get the curriculum. And that may be where we get into more like special ed programs. And this is supposed to be a fluid thing. Perhaps there's times in a school year where a student needs intervention and other times where they've addressed that issue and now they're back into just core instruction. And again, I'm not going to try to deviate too much from our presentation here because I know we got people to hear from. Now getting into what is the definition of RTI? Well, part of it is what RTI is not. It's not a package program or a strategy that can be learned in a single training session. There's not a one-size-fits-all. RTI is a multi-step process of providing high-quality, research-based instruction and interventions at varying levels of intensity to students who struggle with learning. That's all students, any student. The interventions are matched to the student's needs, and their progress is closely monitored at each level of intervention. Students' progress. Membership in the committee can include the following groups: general education teachers, special education teachers, administrators, district staff. District committee members are also members of site management team, potentially, Title I teams, at-risk teams, and just RTI committee members. So we want to make sure that we're getting kind of a broad swath in here. As again, this is supposed to be a general ed function, and we want to make sure we're getting all filters and viewpoints into interventions and instruction. The strategic planning process allocated funding for the 2006-07 school year in order to build capacity for the creation of an RTI foundation district-wide. Rita, you're doing a terrific job, by the way. And what were some of those actions? Well, in 2006-07, researched and defined elements of RTI. That's part of the work the committee did. We discussed purpose of district RTI committee. So it was really kind of the beginning stages. Attended professional development, which we have some people here to talk about. Related to RTI, examples given being DIVLS, which is a literacy screening device, reading recovery, comprehensive literacy model, and we also did some site visitations last year in this. And I think at this point, is this where we wanted to hear from some of our DIVLS people, perhaps? We've got some plants in the audience. They were walking down the street and we dragged them in. But if I could, Laura Kirshner and Kirk Collins are here to talk a little bit about the DIVLS program.
Hi, Kirk Collins, Hawthorne. Just a couple of things. One of the things that I think it would be a better assessment. You know, we have our yearly STAR assessment, and that's great for what it does. But what we found is we needed something that was going to happen throughout the year, so we could assess students, monitor, adjust our groups, teachers adjust their teaching, and reach out to those students, all students, during the school year, and not wait till the end of the year in May and say, "Well, how'd we do?" And so we were really looking for some answers of, you know, how could we do this and not make it where you're constantly assessing, and it's an assessment that takes, you know, days and days to complete. And so we heard about an assessment program called DIBLS, and Laura Kirshner was really instrumental in researching that and bringing it to our school, and she's going to tell you a little bit about that.
So DIBLS is one assessment that can be used, and we are kind of liking it because it's inexpensive, it's quick, it gives you lots of information. So, and it assesses the areas of phonemic awareness, accuracy, fluency, comprehension, alphabetic principle, which includes phonics, stuff like this, which we did, and to assess where kids were at risk, which is so much different than the old special education wait to fail model. So it's really great to be able to work with them when we see like a little glitch there. So let's put them in an 8-week group of fluency, of phonemic awareness, whatever. So we're excited about that. In the winter, we went to the progress monitoring workshop with some regular general ed classroom teachers, which was really exciting. We're continuing to DIBL, also use some of the scores with the tests that we already have, like the SRI, and getting all kinds of good information.
Thank you. That reminds me that I know that there's some other DIBL's committee members here in the audience. I don't know if you guys want to wave or stand up and say hello to the... Any of those options? Very good. That was a wave, by the way. Pardon me? Oh, Rita wants me to read people's names. She's so bossy. Who did we highlight? I saw Janet Gould here, Joyce Hansen. Was Joyce here? Okay, Joyce Hunter, too. I'm sorry. Joyce Hansen and Joyce Hunter. And then Laura Kirshner, and then Steve Anderson was here, but he had to leave. So he says hell, by the way. Okay. But that's just an example of, I think, schools being able to go in and get more assessments in a quick way, get those interventions in place. And again, that's a general ed function. Okay, so it's not just meant for kids that have qualified for a quote-unquote special program. And we did attend a DIBL's in-service in Atascadero a handful of months ago, and that was heavily attended by a lot of the elementary school sites. So money's hard at work. Next part here, strategic planning process. Did I already talk about this? Yeah, I did. Okay, we're going on to the next page, aren't we? Oh, and this is also what the committee did last year, was after wading through all the materials, all the literature, all the dogma, how do we kind of make this kind of a something we can latch on to and work from? And so they came up with what they thought was a good definition or working model for DIBL. So district-supported, school-based, systematic response to all students' learning that answers the questions. What do students need to learn? How do we know if they've learned it? And what do we do if they don't? Okay, so now I'm going to sit down and let Rita talk to you about how we address some of those questions.
I think before there might be a question.
Oh, my goodness.
People who attend the in-service will be able to pass that information on, and then it can be put into practical application at other school sites?
We have had those conversations, and I'm sure Laura could address it best if she worked on it, but absolutely. I mean, that is the idea, that it is something that you can have peer and mentor coaches, you know, going to sites, teaching other people. Absolutely. It's supposed to be user-friendly, but you got to get your feet wet, that's for sure.
Thank
I addressed
you.
Your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mark?
Martin.
Mr. Buckman.
Hi. How are you, sir? I'm impressed with the people and the quality of the people that are on the committee. Was there any consideration given to putting a parent on the committee, special ed or somebody from the county's self? But there's a committee that they have up.
Yeah, I have no working knowledge that was part of the...
came up. I know we extended the membership of our RTI committee this year from what it was last year, but I think that's a very good suggestion, and there's no reason why we wouldn't be able to do that.
Thank you. And then my really serious question is, was this program chosen just because the name's really cute?
RTI.
No,
DIBL.
Adrian?
It was a reauthorization of IDEA, Individuals with a Disability Education Act, in 2004.
Correct.
When RTI started.
Correct.
And I'm not really sure President Bush had anything to do with that except signing it.
But
the main problem was that it took so long for students to be identified into special education with that discrepancy model, the discrepancy between their IQ or perceived ability and their achievement.
Correct.
That they got so far behind before they finally had an IEP.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's research. This is my question. I think I've been reading some research that there already are statistics about how many fewer students have to receive special education services because of the effectiveness of early interventions. Mm-hmm. Do you know of any of those yet?
No, I don't have those statistics.
Have you heard? There are some coming out already.
Well, I think some things that would bear what it is that you're saying is that there are certainly more students that are being assessed for special education than qualified for special education. So that to me kind of speaks to there being kind of a misdiagnosis per se of a need for services. So I think now the idea too, not only about that
struggling with some aspect of their education, they would go through this, the process.
Sure, and I think that to look at it as a process is just be considered, I think, good teaching techniques. You know, again, identifying what it is you want students to know, finding out if they know it or not, and then once you've determined that, if they don't know it, what are we going to do about it? And in a quick and a timely fashion before that problem escalates, deepens, and all the other adverse effects come out of that.
Adrian? It's good to see you again, Marty. We don't get to see you nearly as much as we used to.
Well, I'll come visit more.
A comment really, or as a teacher in special education, I thought there is an irony in this, that the students who do not respond to intervention are ultimately identified as needing special education services. But if you're the teacher of students who don't respond to intervention, and your job is to provide interventions, there's a little irony there about how difficult it is, but you just continue providing interventions. And mm-hmm. And they do learn as much as possible, hopefully. And that could be quite a lot of learning.
Sure. Well, and I also think that student to educator ratio gets reduced as students work up that continuum as well. So, right.
Martin, quick question.
Where's that voice?
Right back here.
Okay.
over in the corner.
The music has stopped, right? When I came up, the music stopped.
Yeah, I think celestial. Celestial intervention has stopped. But,
yes.
What percentage, what number of the students have been tested so far with this program?
With DIBLS per se?
Yeah.
Well, that it's part of RTI. The philosophy is that schools get to drive what it is they need to move forward at a site and what intervention screenings they want to use. So my understanding with DIBLS is that it's really been something that's been embraced at Hawthorne Elementary. There's schools that are doing other things. You know, Monarch Grove has comprehensive literacy model. So there's many different screening devices and data collection that could be used. So we're kind of hoping, too, that as this proves to be successful or not, if it works, great, we'll embrace it. Maybe other schools will start using it. If we find out it's not an effective model, well, hey, let's try another one. And what do we learn from this? So I think to answer your question, I think Hawthorne is the only school I know that is fully 100% of
What's the level of discussion between the school sites regarding the various choices and the benefit of this program versus other approaches or other efforts?
Great question, and this is meant as a segue. That's part of what Rita is going to actually discuss.
Yes, I can read communication efforts from the committee to the other schools regarding your findings and recommendations.
Other schools, you mean?
Other school sites.
Within our own school district?
Yes.
All or most of our schools are represented on the RTI committee, and so the responsibilities of those members are to take that information back to the school sites.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
We'll put the next one on, please. Okay. Okay, so one of the main questions and part of the definition that the committee came up with was, what do students need to learn? And so what we have there are some notes about our work as far as how we are identifying what students need to learn. And so what we have there are essential standards, and at the elementary level, some of those essential standards that we are identifying is in process right now. Our elementary teachers are working on identifying essential English language arts standards. But aside from that, we have identified some before in our school improvement plans and also in some of the elementaries where they focused on math at certain grade levels to determine what they feel is most important for students at those grade levels to learn. At the secondary level, we have identified through a process that began about a year and a half ago essential standards in English language arts and mathematics, and they also have program, I mean, school improvement plan objectives related to what they feel students should be learning. And then, of course, you know, in all our areas where we have content standards, those are our essential learnings, what we want students to know as we're addressing standards. And at this moment, what I'd like to do is have Darla Batistic step up and let you know how this work is going at the elementary level as far as identifying the essential English language arts standards.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Darla Batistic, and I'm a sixth grade teacher at C.L. Smith, and I have been able to be a part of a very exciting project under the guidance of Barry Penley and Rita Deliscamp. We have put together a committee in the district consisting of two teachers and the principal from each elementary site to select and identify the most essential language arts standards in kindergarten through sixth grade. And we met for our first standards in language arts. The teachers will be guided into what to put their focus into, and then we can measure student success against those specific standards to ensure mastery of those standards. We met in January to come up with the process, and then we took the process to all of the elementary sites on our professional development day on January 25th. All of the elementary teachers met at various sites around the district to discuss what would be the 20 most essential standards in language arts at each grade level. Some schools met on their own at sites. Some schools collaborated together to select the 20 essential standards. We used the framework, the California framework, the blueprints from the STAR test, and teacher experience to come up with what we thought the 20 most essential standards were. It was an exciting day with lots of passionate debate and professionalism. It was a long day, but at the end, I think we really were celebrating that we had accomplished something. From there, each site's selected 20 essential standards were taken back to the essential standards committee, the two teachers and principal from each site. And we looked at what was selected by all schools. And then we went to narrowing it down to what were the top 20 in each grade level based on what all of the schools thought. And that narrowing down process came up with a tentative list of the 20 most essential standards in language arts. And the next step, we haven't pursued it, but the next step is going on right now. Those proposed standards are being taken back to the elementary sites where all teachers, again, will have a look at the standards and make revisions and make suggestions. And then it'll come back to the committee in May. And then the committee will begin the finalization of these are the 20 essential standards at each grade level. At that same time, the committee will start working on rewriting the essential standards in kid-friendly terms so that they can be shared with parents and students so that everybody's on board at what it is exactly that we want students to master in every grade level in language arts. In the future, next year, we'll be looking at putting together benchmark assessments. Actually, at the end of this year, we'll calendar those 20 essential standards by trimester and say these will be the ones taught in the first trimester, second trimester, and third trimester, and then next year follow with some benchmarks. We experienced some successes in language arts. We'd like to move the same process into mathematics.
Thank you very much. Chris, you might have a couple questions, and you have to stay in the spotlight.
And I guess my question really sort of refers to the last comments that you made, and I'm not sure who's going to answer it, but my understanding is that RTI dovetails into professional learning communities and the whole idea of teacher collaboration. My concern or my question is, how are we doing that? How are we assuring that teachers get the collaboration time that they need in order to make RTI effective? And I guess in order to collaborate on the agreement of standards that you're talking about. So I'd appreciate it if somebody can answer that question for
me. That's a bigger question than me. Thank you, Carla.
You know, that's all in process. In some of our schools, that's in place. There's a collaboration time. And in other schools, they're working with the resources they have, being able to have some substitutes so they can pull teachers together of the same grade level. So it's going on even though the perfect structures aren't there yet.
At some point, I would be interested in hearing if there is support that the school board can provide for allowing teachers to be able to collaborate within their school day to move forward on RTI and professional learning communities.
Sure, and I believe that's an upcoming agenda item. We'll be talking about collaboration time.
Thank you.
It's interesting to me to see all the excited teachers, and I'm very interested in the teacher comments about this. I have a question, though. There's something I don't get about this, and that is, how does an intervention work along with calendar? Because if a student, there's the things you want to cover, and your learners are all different. So some of them are getting it, and they're right on schedule, and some kids are not getting it. So then you're going to reteach. You have the interventions, which take time. You know, then they didn't get it on the intervention yet. So we got another intervention, and we're still on that one standard. And the rest of the calendar is coming up. We've got to have a test now on the first five standards, and we're still trying to do interventions on the second one. That's the part I've
learned it. And what we did was we compiled a list here of some of the elementary examples of assessments that we have and currently use. It doesn't mean that all of the schools are using all of these, okay? Otherwise, we'd be testing our students to death. But schools use many of these, okay? And so there, I'm not going to read through every single one. You heard, I believe, SRI mentioned earlier, the Scholastic Reading Inventory, and you may have heard DRA mentioned. Both of those are used at all of our elementary schools. So these are examples of elementary multiple assessments, and the next slide has some of the assessments that are used at the secondary level. And we put in there articulation between teachers and counselors and collaboration, because it is that collaboration and articulation that, and looking at student progress, that helps us to determine what are some of the interventions that are needed. Okay.
Mr. Millar, just a quick question.
Reed, I just wanted, and we may not know the answer to this, I'm concerned that the articulation between teachers and counselors seems to be an important piece of this, and one of the recurrent complaints that at least I've heard from parents is the counselor services at the secondary level, particularly the high schools. Do we have sufficient counselor resources so that this articulation can be done in a meaningful way in addition to all the other responsibilities the counselors have? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's not a question for you.
I'm not sure.
Dr. Valentine?
Dr. Metash.
Well, as you know, we have a special grant for supplemental counseling services, so the ratio to a student to counselor ratio is at 350-1. And we've really made a commitment to work as a team effort to ensure that our students are receiving the support that they need in collaboration with counselors, in collaboration with their teachers. So it is a commitment that we are focusing on now, especially with the reduced caseload that they have at the secondary level.
And there is that focus on at-risk students that was part of the information shared with us. Okay. And so then we go to the third question, which is probably the most interesting one. What are we going to do if our students aren't meeting our objectives as far as what we expect them to learn? And we have examples there of various elementary interventions.
Amy put up the tool that we're currently using this year. We ask all the teachers to complete this form for students that scored mid-basic, below basic, or far below basic on the STAR assessment. So they complete this at the beginning of the year. Our K-2 teachers complete a similar form, but they don't have the STAR test results to include on their form. And As you can see, that we compile all the data on one form, and by compiling the data in one place, we can see patterns of strengths and weaknesses that would occur, and this allows us to develop targeted interventions based on student needs. And she's showing you the bottom half of the form. It's one page that we made bigger so you could see it. And so we meet in a marathon SST meeting and come up with the targeted interventions, and we've evolved the process somewhat since the beginning of the year. At the beginning of the year, we were thinking we'd meet just mid-year and end of the year, but actually what we decided we needed to do was to meet at the end of the first and second trimester, and we reevaluate based on assessment data on where students are in their interventions, and we've regrouped and shuffled kids around. And then we plan also to meet again in June to look at end-of-the-year assessment data to see how the interventions went and to roughly map out where intervention grouping should start at the beginning of the next school year so we can get a jump start on next year. And then Amy's going to do the next step.
Good evening. Amy Shields from C.L. Smith. What Joyce has put up is the first page of our current set of academic interventions that we have at C.L. Smith. And these are what we call Tier 2. And you remember Martin showed you the pyramid, and at the bottom, that 80%, that's your core, awesome, wonderful, incredible instruction going on in classrooms. That little second piece is what we call targeted intervention groups. You'll notice on there that it covers a lot of different grade levels. This is just what we do at C.L. Smith in the area of English language arts, reading, writing. I put reading recovery in there because I didn't want you to think first grade was being shorted when actually that is truly a Tier 3 intervention. That's at the very top of the pyramid because that's our most intensive one-on-one intervention. But because we're able in this district to service so many students in that area, I didn't want it to be forgotten because I'm just talking about Tier 2. Provide targeted interventions based on all those assessments and those marathon SSTs this way without having students miss any of their core instruction. In the area of mathematics, if you would go to the next one, we do a combination of before, during, and after school interventions. These targeted groups are taught by paraeducators or instructional aides as directed by the classroom teacher. Students are not in these groups permanently. For example, the Math Buddies group, which is one I enjoy because it's one that I get to do at lunchtime with second and third graders, is for students who have not quite mastered their math facts. We spend some time practicing, do little tests on them, they get them, and they're out. They're short-term, short levels. Some of them are a little bit longer, but we don't want kids in these interventions any longer than they need to be. And in answer to your question, so they're still getting their core math instruction in their classroom. They're still moving on to the next area while we're getting those facts down or whatever it is that they might be needed in that. Something new this year is that before-school math reteach that we're doing in 4th, 5th, and 6th grade. We have that three segments of the year. We're taking those big pieces of math instruction, and for kids that need that, really do need to go over it again, be it their, we did number sense, we're about to start a fraction unit. For those that just didn't quite get it, need a little extra support, let's go back and review those big core ideas in learning fractions that they're going to need to move on to the next area. As far as homework interventions, these, yes, are all after-school interventions. Our Mustang Readers is something we were able to start this year. We hire an hourly teacher, and then in addition to that, we're using student California Teacher Association members from Cal Poly, and they come over 4 afternoons a week. We hook them up one-on-one with first and second graders, priority to our English learners first, and then other students whose parents might not speak English at home. They do practice reading at a leveled reading. They practice their little flashcards, and then they get a jump start on their homework every night. So it's just a great program for kids to help them get through, get in, and get out. AVID, I know you're all aware of AVID because you helped fund that for our schools. Our after-school
AVID tutorial is not only help with homework, but it's also help for targeted students, students that we choose to be there. We really want them there. And they're getting organization skills. They're getting binders.
Next slide has some examples of secondary intervention occurring. And we have someone from the secondary level, Kathy Ahern, who is a teacher at Laguna Middle School, who's going to speak to the reading interventions there.
Hello. I'm going to speak on behalf of Sandra Del Martini, who cannot be here. She teaches two reading classes at Laguna Middle School. Students in her classes are chosen for the regular education reading classes in one of four ways. Most students are recommended by a current teacher, counselor, or parent who sees the student struggling to understand the reading material presented in class. Students are also placed in the class if they have received a reading score of 35% or lower on the reading section of the STAR test taken annually in the spring. Once in the class, the students receive support in fluency and comprehension through the use of district and board-approved reading programs, Rewards, Rewards Plus, Read Naturally, and Accelerated Reader. Students also receive a double dose of English when novels being read in the English classes are also being read in the reading classes. Throughout the year, student progress is monitored by the district-approved computerized STAR reading tests and accelerated reader tests. The Stanford Diagnostic Reading Test and the Suture ALRED Placement Test are given at the beginning and the end of the year to gauge student growth and comprehension. Normally, students do not transfer out at the semester. They are enrolled in the class for a full year and often take the class again as eighth graders if they were enrolled in the class as seventh graders. At the conclusion of the school year, if a student has been enrolled in the class for two semesters and there are no mitigating circumstances, an average grade level improvement of 2 years is shown on the Suture ALRED Placement Test, Stanford Diagnostic Reading Test, and STAR Computerized Reading Test. And those are for students that are regular education students. I teach the ELD reading class, the EL students at Laguna, and they're placed in the reading program based on their CELT scores and teacher recommendation. Students that are in one of two reading classes at Laguna in my class. One reading class is for students who are at CELT levels 1 and 2, and those classes, and the other class is for students at levels 3 and 4. Students at levels 1 and 2 are students at the beginning and early intermediate levels of their English speaking abilities. Students at levels 3 and 4 are at the intermediate and early advanced levels of their English speaking abilities, which includes listening, speaking, reading, writing, and their overall proficiency level in English ability. Once in this class is monitored by the district-approved computerized STAR test as well, the online Rosetta Stone language learning program, and the Read Naturally program for fluency and comprehension. Normally, students stay in my class for the whole year. They're enrolled in the class and usually stay with me from 7th through 8th grade, depending upon their CELT level, their CST scores, teacher recommendation, and parent requests. At the conclusion of the school year, the average EL student improves on their CELT score by one level or more, and they advance one or more levels in their fluency in the Read Naturally program, and some are even RFEPT, which stands for Redesignated as Fluent English Speaker, and then they go into regular classes, and then we monitor them until they go into the high school. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So as you can see, we have a lot of great teachers and a lot of great staff in our schools, and we may not have the perfect answer yet. We have some work to do still regarding RTI. We need to fine-tune, but as you can see, there's a lot of passion and energy that is going into helping our students. So some of the next steps that we're considering here is within our committee, and you asked before, how do schools communicate what they're doing? At our next committee meeting, we're going to have the different sites share their current response to intervention system practices, because some may be further along than others. Some may have a more systematic way or certain forms they're using that would benefit other sites. And so what we want to do is we want to create and we want to be able to sustain a well-integrated system of instruction and interventions that are guided by student outcome data. Okay, so it's not quite the fine-tuned system yet, but that is our goal. And of course, we want to identify areas of need requiring site and district support, just as Mr. Unger said. Well, we need to know also how can the board support PLC. Well, we want to see how we might be able to support our sites in continuing to grow our TI systems.
Rita, thank you so much for that. And I think there's more questions to Adrian.
Mrs. Delkiskamp and all, I went to a session at the school board conference on RTI, and they didn't have anything happening. No presenters were there from secondary, but because on this standard, and the groups were fluid, but that's how the instruction was all happening at the same time, and so they could move up and down. Was that how the success time went? Is that everyone in the school is in their group at the same time? Okay, and they're all getting instruction at their level. That's what I was going to ask you. So that's what that model looks like, and that's what you're using. They were so excited about it. And it sounds like you are, too. That's good.
Thank you. Mark?
If I could, we've lived under the old model of IQ versus, and is the sense at this point, do you have any sense whether this is going to be better for students, better for staff in identifying students than the old model, or we'd like to beat up the changes that were brought in with No Child Left Behind, but maybe this one is good.
You know, there. I was reading an article, and there aren't many states. I think there are only two states so far that have moved to just using RTI as the system for identifying what students might need special education. The rest of the states, including California, and including our district, are still using the discrepancy model, okay? But as we build this program, I think it's what was mentioned earlier, the sooner, that's why you see more interventions at the elementary, the sooner we can intervene with students, the less likely that they're going to need to have special education.
You have to come up to the microphone for the public. For your public, go ahead and say
that. Yeah, well, okay, there you go. I'm back. I think an important part of it is that it does promote dialogue between professionals. You know, as you're hearing people are getting together, whether they're calling it RTI or not, you know, you want them talking about something they're passionate about, which is students and improving their educations. So to me, is it a good thing? Sure sounds like it so far.
Catherine, thank you very much, Martin.
And just from a layperson's, from a parent's point of view, it's very exciting to go into the teachers' conference room at your individual school and to be able to see where the teachers have worked from kindergarten through sixth grade, and they've come up with these long lists of what the children are going to focus on and learn that year, and to see that evolve from kindergarten through sixth grade. From a parent, to know what their child is going to start out with and then where they're going to end is very comforting, and it sounds like you're going to be putting that in child-friendly and parent-friendly language, so all the inside baseball talk today will be translated to something that can be very meaningful to parents. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And also, I just wanted to thank everyone who came tonight to help with this presentation, and I think it's incredible the amount of energy and commitment, and it was great to hear about the collaboration direction, because I think if what you're exhibiting tonight in terms of discussing these programs and what they mean for the students and how you all contribute the extra time to help particular students is communicated to the other sites and we start developing this district-wide, every student will benefit. But I think it's incredible the amount of commitment, the amount of energy, and I would just like to remind people who are listening to this that as we in several months down the road have a discussion about finances, these are the programs that this district is able to do because of extra funding, and that's the extra funding that sometimes is jeopardized by the cuts that we hear. We're fortunate we have a community-based school district that is supported by the community in many more ways, and I think we have to keep that in mind. These don't happen accidentally. It's because of the staff and the teachers and the commitment, but also the funding that we have to make sure is there, because this is terrific stuff. Thank you.
Thank you. I have my microphone.
I'm sorry, we have one other thing. Don't leave yet. I missed a microphone. Marilyn.
I don't know who can answer this, or it may not be an answerable question at this point, but when talking about collaboration time, which seems to be so integral to making this be successful, can you explain to me how we are creating collaboration time now for teachers?
Okay. At the secondary level, it's established. For example, at Morro Bay High School and at San Luis Obispo High School, they have the late start,
Mondays,
and that's collaboration. At Laguna, I believe it's after school on Wednesdays, and off the top of my head, I don't see anybody from Los Osos, so I can't remember when it is.
After school also?
Wednesdays, I believe.
Thank you. As far as the elementary level, that's where it's a little bit more challenging, but our principals are creative, and some of our schools, for example, at Hawthorne, they do have a collaboration time. I believe it's Wednesday. Early dismissal, and that's when the teachers collaborate. At other elementary sites where they don't have that in place, they are, in a sense, buying time. So they will periodically pay for substitutes so that the teachers from a certain grade level can get together and review the assessment data on students and have these important conversations about interventions.
Great. So we're acknowledging the importance of it, and we're creating the space for it, and we'll continue to
keep working
to enable
it.
That
yes.
collaboration to occur. And then I wanted to ask also at the secondary level, the articulation between teachers and counselors. Sometimes it appears that there's not enough time for articulation between students and counselors. When and how are we creating the space for teachers and counselors to work together with regard to student achievement?
One example of how this works, sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean that a teacher and a counselor are sitting together in a meeting, but for example, in the area of reading, counselors from, for example, San Luis Obispo High School, along with counselors and teachers from Laguna Middle School, review information on students who may need extra assistance or intervention in reading. So it doesn't necessarily mean one student at a time and them two sitting together. Sometimes it's a team of people who come together for a meeting.
Okay, thank you.
And if I could, I should have just sat down. I don't think it's fair to represent all of the committee members and their attitudes towards collaboration time, if they feel like they're getting adequate time or not. I know those are conversations we want to continue as part of the committee. I know it's an ongoing concern of others. And, you know, maybe there's principal, maybe that's a dialogue for another night, I'm sure. And maybe there's people that want to address that now. I don't know. But that is something that isn't completely settled, I think is fair to say.
So, like you. The rest of the whole response to intervention, it's an ongoing process. It's evolving.
Right. And they're very individual, I think, the needs and concerns at a site level.
Okay. So. Thank you.
That's everything. Thank you. Sorry for overlooking that first question. Dr. Matakovich?
Yes, just in the area of collaboration, you asked that we bring a board item to you relative to PLCs and collaboration, and we plan to do that at your next meeting. So we hope to elaborate more on that topic for you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments regarding this agenda item? Thank you again very much. We really, really appreciate the effort and the energy. Thank you. Next on the agenda is the physical fitness accountability portion, and I believe Dr. Matakovich will present this. Thank you.
Please, if I could. Well, given your decision to allow athletes to apply for athletic exemptions from physical education during their season of sport, the need for physical fitness accountability surfaced. You asked that we bring forward a response to how we're ensuring that our athletes are demonstrating fitness. We'd like to share with you the direction from the State Board of Education and the California Department of Ed that focuses on our graduation requirements and what their expectations are, as well as their testing expectations. You also raised two questions. Are our athletes fit? And are these athletes being instructed in physical education standards? And we hope through this presentation we can answer these questions for you. In the area of physical fitness accountability, first of all, we have graduation requirements, as you know. All students are required to be eligible to graduate from high school. They take two courses in physical education unless the district grants an exemption. You have a reference document in your with your item that delineates those exemptions. There are four of them, and our students are entitled to have access to these exemptions. We can go into more detail about those later if you so choose. There is the physical fitness test, and each school district is required to administer this test to all fifth, seventh, and ninth grade students. There are six areas of fitness that are assessed. And if you would, Rita. And these are the areas that the state feels all students need to be assessed on in order to determine their fitness. The beauty of this test is it provides valuable information to our students who are assessed to help them plan their own personal fitness program. It's also designed to help our teachers as they look at their curriculum in physical education. As well, this information is provided to parents so that they can understand their children's fitness levels. So, given this assessment, are our athletes fit? Well, to determine this, our staff tabulated the fitness results for our current 10th grade class. These students took the assessment at the 9th grade. You have a reference document in the board item, attachment B, that has detailed information. But to cut to the quick, basically, our 9th grade athletes who took this test passed at a very high rate, 84%. Our non-athletes passed at a lower rate, 64%. Overall, we did a very good job at 74% as far as being looked at across the county. It's important to note that our 7th grade students' passing rate was 72% overall, so we're seeing an increase in proficiency with our students at the 9th grade level. Now, when we talk to staff about why the high pass rates for our athletes, they attribute it to several things. One, their extensive conditioning and their sports skills development, the daily amount of time they spend in their sport, and also their coach's commitment to providing quality programs. In speaking with our athletic directors, and they're here tonight, John Andre and Vic Eklund, they kind of describe what an athlete's day is all about. They have their athletic period, and then before and after school time they spend in practice. This an athlete could realize 1 to 3 hours a day involved with their program. This time is spent conditioning, which could include jogging, a quarter mile, active stretching, movement patterns, agility drills, weight work, core exercises specific to the sport, and then, of course, the warm down that they do after their activities. They have specific sport skill development, and then, of course, the actual competition ensues. A statement's been made that there's an expectation that our athletes should pass this physical fitness test as a condition for their exemption eligibility. That's been raised. By so doing so, the students who have exercised their right to apply for an exemption would be held to a higher standard than any other student in our district. We feel that our students in our athletic program at the rate of their at their proficiency rate are doing a fine job. If you look at your chart, you'll see that about 11% of our students were not able to take the test. And so we have kind of a remaining 5% of our students who are not necessarily passing the physical fitness test. 12 to 15 students are involved in that. And we think that with the support of their coaches, that these students can be involved in a committed personal fitness plan, which is what they do as athletes. We also feel that the expectation that adding an additional testing schedule for these athletes into the schedule would be an extra requirement that our athletes and our coaches would have to meet. And we are really recommending that no additional conditions be placed upon these students who are applying for this athletic exemption. So in answering question two, are our athletes being instructed in physical and the physical education standards? Well, our coaches and athletes took an initial look at the standards. And as you know, our PE educators have been involved in developing course one and course two of our core physical education program. And our coaches and athletic directors have generated specific ideas by sport as an initial look at these standards to begin the conversation about what standards do they touch on in their athletic program. This work has been done independently of our physical education curriculum development process. As I stated, the physical education teachers right now, just within the last week, have finished the final stages of analyzing our core program. This analysis that they've done, of course, 1 and 2, the 9th and 10th grade physical education course, will provide a foundation document for our athletic directors and their coaches to use as a reference as they move forward in their quest to provide a quality program. In summary, we feel our district's meeting the requirements set by the State Board of Education and CDE. We do use exemptions, as you know, if the student meets the statutory requirement. The physical fitness test is administered as required. Our athletes are performing at a higher level on these tests. And yes, they can do a better job of looking at all of the athletes who are not necessarily achieving this performance level given their athletic plan. We think that further study of our athletes' performance and our non-athletes' performance can both provide input to our athletic program as well as our physical education program. We feel with the support of the physical education staff who have just reviewed our course one and two, that their expertise and work in conjunction with our athletic directors and coaches can help to better emphasize the standards as they align to each individual sport. So we're prepared to participate in the discussion. Our principals are here tonight, as well as our athletic directors, and we look forward to your input on this matter.
You know, I had one comment, and then I'm sure others will also. To me, it's never been a matter of our student athletes being given a break from the additional requirement of the physical education schedule because they're in a sports program. Always, it's been a matter of what do you do with the 62 to 65% of the non-student athletes that are performing at a lower level on a test? And I think the test is relative in terms of how strenuous it is. It's seen in different ways. And the student athlete who may not be getting those standard-based elements of physical education that deal with lifelong health, diet, and exercise. To me, it's not a matter of the student athlete being given an exemption. It's a matter of how our district educates our students at the time they get to graduation, where they are as fit as they can be with the best type of program that our physical education department can provide to those who may not be in an athletic endeavor, but also those who are in organized athletics leave a high school, leave our district with an idea that it's just not what they accomplished in high school on the field, it's what they bring with them the rest of their lives in terms of their own health, their own well-being, their own diet, and their own physical education program. I know that there is this diversity or this divergence in our schools, especially the high schools, where the student athletes are here and the others who don't participate are over here. So my question is not so much the exemption, but how can we raise the ones who are at 62 and 65% much higher, who are just sent in a physical education program, and how can we make sure the students who are on the field are learning these factors that are in the standards for the rest of their life in terms of their own well-being, their own diet, and their own exercise. It's an educational process. It's not a student-athlete issue. It's not a student who's not in an organized sport. So do we strengthen the physical education program to help the children who are coming through to the ninth grade that aren't passing this test, who won't be in an organized sport, to improve on those abilities in the future? And do we also recognize that some of the students who are in an organized sporting program aren't learning some of the factors that they need to take with them when they leave high school in terms of their lifelong physical wealth and health and well-being? So to me, it's a bigger picture issue, and I don't argue with the exemption. I think that's all correct.
Well, if I may comment on the work that Rita Deliskamp has been doing with our K-12 physical education teachers relative to the standards, they have spent, well, actually for the last 2 years, looking at the standards that we've been given by the state. They've been doing a process called unpacking the standards. I think that probably this year there have been 20 days of committed time that these teachers have given to analyzing the standards and understanding what they're about. I think this floor of understanding what these standards are at each grade level and then developing what those assessments are going to be to determine that we know what kids have learned and can move forward, I think will only assist us as we develop our physical education program, K-12. I think that we have solid physical education teachers who are having an opportunity to fine-tune their program with guidance from the state. And I think that that, in turn, as I said, the document that has been provided, the secondary athletic program, will assist them in terms of looking at the whole picture in terms of what standards we expect students to know and be able to do. So we are at the knowledge application level in the area of physical education, and I think with the two joining together, I think we can better understand what we're expecting all kids to know and be able to do.
Okay. Mark?
I think Chris Smith. Sure. I appreciate your and applaud your comments there, John. I think that's really my feeling, that it's not, that what we want is we want our regular students who are not athletes to be, if not as physically fit, but at least as conscious of physical fitness and hopefully taking the steps toward lifelong commitment to physical fitness, as we want our athletes to be able to do too. I admit that it was my idea, I think, to suggest the 5 of 6 for participation. I don't know that that's necessary, and I don't know that that's fair for student athletes to say you can't participate if you don't pass the test. What I do think is fair, though, is that that both of our student athletes and our regular physical education students be working toward the same goals. It feels to me as if there's, I'm going to use this word cautiously, sort of a schism between the coaches and the PE teachers about what the expectations are for student athletes on the one hand for the coaches and physical education students on the other hand. I think that needs to be bridged. I appreciate Dr. Matakovich's efforts on this, and Dr. Matakovich and I spent probably about 35 or 40 minutes last night talking about this. One of the things that she described to me was this effort to move forward on looking at the sports, I think, and how can the various sports align themselves toward the physical fitness standards. And I think the physical fitness standards are important. I think that otherwise they wouldn't be there. I mean, we have a choice of, it's a bigger picture for me, if I think about it, are we going to ignore standards or not? And I think that we have, if nothing else, we have standards. We need to go forward on the standards. I would look forward and I would ask that the board direct the staff to look at ways of aligning the various sports toward the physical fit, toward the physical education standards, or at least demonstrating that we're on that road to doing that, as well as you suggest, John, making sure that we have the highest quality, most exceptional physical education program that we can have for all of our students. I would refer people to yesterday's health section of the Los Angeles Times, the back page. You know, we can talk about lots of theories, but I believe there is evidence that physically fit students, physically fit individuals, physically fit humans have consistently higher quality lives, age more slowly, and are cognitively more aware. So that would be my interest, that the staff continue to move forward to that, and that both the coaches and the physical education teachers work together for all of our students. And then I would like to see that brought back within a reasonable time with progress reports on what's being done and some of that commitment. So that would be my request.
I think Mark and then Adrian.
Thank you, John. I too have spent some time talking with Mrs. Matakovich, and I want to thank Rita for her time that she spent working on getting the PE standards into some kind of understandable language and framework that we can use in our community. We pride ourselves in being one of the best districts in the state, and I came across a statement the other day that shocked me, and it goes something like, our children have a lower life expectancy than their parents. This is the first time in history that that's happened. And that, I think, is the impetus behind a lot of what we're doing with PE and a lot of what we're trying to do. And it scares me, and I want to be sure that this district is at the forefront of this. The charts that were provided were very helpful in trying to make a decision on this. And a lot of it was geared towards, this is the amount of kids that passed the test. But 30% of the regular students didn't pass the test. That's a large percentage number. And 15% of the athletes didn't pass the test. And I think we have to ask ourselves, is that acceptable? 15% of our athletes were unable to pass what's a pretty basic fitness test. But what really scared me was when I got to item 10 later in this agenda, and it looks like we're being asked to approve the requirements for coaches, walk-on coaches. And that item lists a lot of things that, you know, a recreational coach, an AYSO coach, a club coach would be required to know. But what it doesn't ask anything about fitness. It doesn't ask anything about life skills. It doesn't ask anything about understanding the PE standards. And I think we're missing an opportunity. If we can ask our walk-on coaches to be one step higher than, you know, a coach that's out there on the regular basis. So I want to echo what Chris is saying. I really think it's time for the coaches and the PE teachers to continue to work together to do what's best for the children. So I've listened to staff, and what I'd like to see and add to what Chris is asking for, I'd almost like to see an annual report, at least for the time being, that does this breakout of the fitness of athletes and the fitness of regular students to ensure that the students in this district are getting everything that they can possibly get.
Thank you, Mark. Adrian?
I haven't heard anybody saying they want to test athletes, give them a physical fitness test. So it sounds like the board has let go of that requirement. That's what I'm hearing. And I would let go of that. I think that's just too hard to figure out when you would do that, and it's impractical. Going on to the standards part, though, it's not just health, fitness, and diet that are in the standards. There's I got this email from Doug Morrow, and this is an area. This is the one reason that I was hesitant to vote for an exemption, which I did vote for. But this standard about self-responsibility, social interaction, and group dynamics, where sports are very competitive, and you know, you try to win and be the one that's in front, and it doesn't really matter if you're not the one that plays. I mean, competition is different than cooperation. So it seems to me that if you're going to work on, if you're going to have coaches work on these type of standards, it's going to change coaching a little bit to have to, and some of these other ones too, to add in teaching standards. Seems like it's going to change after school athletics a little bit. Is that true? Do you think out there, not or no, or it's not going to change it? Because you already address those things?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, maybe you're like, my son played baseball at Pomona College, and they had Paul Sfagdas as a coach. He was a completely awesome guy. And they'd go places like Cal Lutheran. And these guys were rude and obnoxious. Sorry if there's any Cal Lutheran people out there. And trash talking and all that. And their coach always taught these guys to be scholars and gentlemen. That came first. Scholars and gentlemen. On the field and, you know, in classrooms and all of that. Homework came first. And I'm sure you'd talk about that. But it is such an opportunity of intimacy, really, with adults and kids to learn a lot of life skills. So as long as that's emphasized, I think some of these standards could be covered. But just to be systematic about things like that, I mean, maybe you could even have a day where, you know, it's the group goals, not the individual goals, or the there's not two teams competing, but it's our total score. We, you know, that everyone's involved in making it happen. You can imagine, you know, those kind of games and things. I think there's creative ways to include these. But and there's ways in high school that students do learn these things, like in music classes, they learn a lot about ensemble. It's not just, yeah, come on up, if that's okay with everybody. I'd like to, we invited them to give their input, right?
Correct, sure.
Yeah, good.
John Andre, Athletic Director, Morro Bay High School. Kind of addressing what you brought up, we to be successful as a team, and we talk about this with our coaches all the time, it's more than just winning. We went 11-1 this year, and we didn't use the word win once the whole season. It's about a process. It's about building together. You look at all these championship teams or these teams that are successful, it's because of the fact that they work together as a team, cooperative learning, working in groups, team building, working for a common goal. And I think that covers, you know, I know they do that at San Luis High as well as we do it at Morro Bay High School. That's what sports are. It's more than just winning and losing. And you know, everybody wants to put that you want to win, but yeah, that's the ultimate goal. But it's about a process. It's about becoming better people. We're all constantly grade checks. We're talking about, you know, we use dedication, desire, and discipline. Those are our three D's. And we talk about all the time, you know, off the field, you have to be disciplined as well as in the classroom. It's a lifestyle, you know. And addressing the nutrition stuff, we go all year round. Basically, this summer our kids will be there 2 hours a day, 4 days a week. We talk about nutrition. We talk about healthy lifestyles. We talk about all of that. So, to address all of these standards, for the most part, our teams do most of that.
Can I say one more thing while you're still there? You know, in this RTI, we were talking about instructional assistants teaching small groups, and those people are not credentialed teachers, but they're under the guidance of the special educators and the other teachers and the principals, and it seems like even these walk-on coaches could be closely worked with, you know, on a daily basis, planning lessons, basically, or planning the schedule of what you're going to do that day with the students, and prep them on instructional techniques and goals. I think that could work if as long as it's a sort of a
Well, that's kind of our job as athletic directors.
Right.
You know, we guide the off-campus coaches, and we help them in any areas that they need assistance in and guidance and so forth.
And they're monitored by you, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I think we also have a couple of other questions. Mr. Millar and then Mr. Buckman.
My question, thank you.
Okay,
sorry,
thank you.
I did find it interesting. I wasn't in favor, and I probably still am not, of the athletes having a separate requirement about the fitness tests, but I did find it interesting that Section 51241, subsection B, the two-year exemption, has a condition precedent that the student has to pass the fitness test in grade 9 or they can't be considered for that exemption. So I don't know why, when they came over to Section 51242, which I believe is the exemption we're talking about, that's not a condition precedent. You know, we get into these discussions both in childhood obesity and, you know, in cafeteria and what we're serving and physical fitness and testing. And there was an ancient philosopher who said you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You know, we have these children for 7 hours a day, 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 180-something days. And I think it's good that we provide this countervailing influence to the influences that are rampant in the rest of their lives. But, I mean, what do we do? Do we make it a requirement to graduate from high school that you pass the physical fitness test? It doesn't seem very, to some of us who, you know, are used to working out stuff, it doesn't seem very onerous. But there are a lot of kids that that's just not realistic. And, you know, I kind of guess I'm losing the thread of what we're doing this evening. And I would appreciate any help that I could get from anybody. So.
Maybe Mr. Buckman is
maybe
here
I
to
can,
do that.
Maybe I can do that. Well, I'll try this two ways. I'm wondering whether the board and staff is comfortable with what they've heard Chris and I asking for, or whether we need to do this as a motion. What I'm asking for is some kind of annual report that looks at the FitnessGram results by school, by athlete, by non-athlete, and by cohort, so we can see whether from fifth grade to seventh grade that same group of kids is doing better or not. And Chris, can I try to summarize yours? I think what Chris is asking for is sometime maybe within the next 6 months we get a progress report on aligning sports with the PE framework. And
I don't think you have to do a motion. I think what you have two board members. I think you can get it in an update, or you can get it in any form you'd
okay.
like.
Does that help, Walter?
I have a question,
Mr. Millar.
Okay, may I?
I'm just wondering if you need all those statistics, or maybe just a general report. I don't know. There's so much, you know, statistic gathering and
one
data,
the,
and I don't know.
One of the things. Well, first of all, I hope it's in a database, Rita, and I've got a feeling it's going to fall on your lap. So. Hopefully it's in a database and it's fairly easy to pull apart, and if it's not, then I'm sympathetic. But part of what changed my mind from this requirement to looking at reports was the depth of the reports that were in our agenda packet. So that's why I'm looking at that.
Mr. Millar?
I do wonder what we would do with the information, but beside that, I'd like to hear from the athletic directors and principals about the practicality of aligning baseball, basketball, swimming with state PE content standards. Is that a doable thing?
Don't knock each other over coming yeah. up to the microphone. That's fine.
And while you're coming up, I don't think that...
I mean, can you run a sports program and while aligning the sport itself to the curriculum requirements of PE? Take
okay.
a stab at it.
Well, I think most definitely you can. There's sports specific standards that fit each sport individually. They may not fit totally in some of the aspects. As far as, like, for instance, swimming would address a certain amount of standards all the way through, as to where baseball would not do some of the aquatic piece, but they would definitely run through all the other standards. All the way and completely cover all those standards as we go along. But if you break down each sport versus what the state is asking for in each one of the standard curriculum for physical education. And you'll find that basically the sports are covering all the standards, first run standards. They're really covering 2 and 3 pretty extensively all the way through if you're really trying to look at them and break them down. As far as, again, the socialization part, the health, nutrition, those things are always being talked about through it with our athletes. And our coaches get our athletes, you know, 1 to 3 hours a day, whereas the physical education teacher is going to get them for 30 minutes or 50 minutes, a lot more time to deal with the athletes on a one-on-one individual basis and explain to them the benefits of being healthy, of having lifetime fitness and being active, because that's what they're trained to do, being active through the whole, pretty much their whole high school career, not just in one PE class and then move on after 2 years and not do anything after that. They're actually trained in that aspect quite extensively, pretty much all summer, all year. They go through pretty rigorous program as far as fitness programs and then conditioning.
It's kind of ironic that we're exempting the athletes from the regular PE program when they're probably getting a superior one from their athletic program.
That could be said by some. It's more or less on a different higher level of physical education. It's still physical education. It's still work. It's still being fit and conditioning, but it's just a higher level. They're being taught more complex movement patterns than you would, for instance, in a regular physical education, because it's just more time.
In the converse, if I'm getting what you're saying, sir, the converse is true, too, that there are things being taught in a core PE class that are beyond what the athletes would get in a regular athletic program.
I guess
that was what I was trying to get.
Well, it's probably more variety in that aspect.
Less focused on one particular sport.
Yes, less focused, less individual, you know, training, less specific. So they get just more exposure to other things, but that's not to say that, you know, multiple sport athlete, I mean, I see them all the time going out and do other things other than their sport,
right,
playing.
Good. That helps. Thanks.
And then, thank you, Ms. Reckler. I think we have a couple other questions. Ms. Rogers?
I was going to ask Coach Eklund
right here.
A question. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, she was up first, then I'll give you Catherine. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Okay. Mr. Eklund, or?
Since you're there, huh?
I was halfway with John.
Mr. Andre? I'm wondering, I know that we have teacher coaches, and I would reasonably expect that they would be familiar with the physical education standards, but when we have walk-on coaches, just as an example, you might have someone who has a particular interest in tennis, who played tennis in high school or college, and now wants to share tennis with young people, so becomes a walk-on coach. What is a very small stipend. Do you think that it's reasonable for us to, I guess, the question is for us, and then for you, is it reasonable to expect them to become totally familiar with the PE standards and to try to integrate them into that particular sport? And then my question for you would be, do you think that it's possible for them to do that?
Well, the state of California, I think I introduced, we talked to the board last year about the certificate that all coaches have certificates of coaching, and in the class that they take, they're covering a lot of the standards as far as socialization, how to act, cooperation, all those types of things that they're getting in the coaching course. So they have to have that certificate, have to pass that course. So that's one way.
But working the various muscle groups and all of the comprehensive standards.
Yes, majority of our walk-on coaches go to clinics all the time, so they're always getting up-to-date modern techniques of how to train athletes and how to work with them on a basis. I know when I had a team that no walk-on coach, no coach went on the field without an agenda written out minute by minute by minute where they're going to be and what they're going to teach and what applications they're going to do on the field. So it was all choreographed in a very specific manner. So they could just look down and go. They were mostly directed, and that's my job, too, is to direct the walk-on coaches now in a total program instead of just a small one.
I think then.
Thank you. That's an excellent answer. Coach Andre, would you agree?
Of course he would.
Thank you.
Catherine? Catherine, did you have?
Yes, Coach Eklund. I just wanted to
25% of our student-athletes are not passing the test, according to this graph we have here.
Oh, Catherine, your microphone may not be on.
Sorry, excuse me. Excuse me. Our graph says that 25% total not passed, 25% of our athletes at... That's
I don't
correct,
know if it's,
right? 25%? Yes.
I don't know if it's 25. No. 84% passed.
Yeah. So, ma'am, I'm looking at the did not pass, the total not passed. Yes, please.
Yes, when you're speaking specifically of San Luis High School, and San Luis High School had 75% of their athletes pass, with 25% not passing, and there were a variety of students percentages, 15 or 7%. Passed 4 of 6 and so forth, with 11% of the students not taking the test.
That was what I wanted to point out, actually. Yes. So, okay. So when it said 25% hadn't passed, but 11 had not taken the test, which could be they were injured, as athletes tend
to
be.
I'm the one that tested them. Some were injured, couldn't do all the tests that day. We did it in a very limited, small block of time. It could have been that They were missing school. Some did come in school. Some were injured. Some had left school. They were no longer in school by the time we tested them. They started in the fall, played a fall sport, and by the spring they'd moved to a different school. I think there's three of those individuals that's what happened when they just left the district. They were gone, so they didn't get tested. So those were all thrown into the mix. The injuries, the ones that couldn't do it, maybe absent, or we just missed.
And some of the criteria they're tested against, it would be sort of self-selecting that some athletes may not qualify. For example, I think of very muscular football players who the sit and reach because of the muscle mass and maybe the aerobic capacity as well. Can you speak to some of the criteria that we're looking at here and whether or not we should be concerned of which of these they pass and they do not pass?
We could look at the ones they didn't pass and why they may not have passed them. Flexibility is one thing that's always worked on, for no matter what the sport or what the level is. Cardiovascular fitness, as far as running the mile and being cardio fit, I'd say majority of our athletes could do it if they were trained to do it. I mean, no matter how big they were, they could all do it in 12 minutes. It's just that the reason they didn't pass is an injury, or they weren't there, or some circumstance that they didn't get tested in the mile at one particular time, or the sit and reach. So isn't just some people just aren't very flexible. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a dynamic of the body, and they're just not flexible at all. No matter how much you train them, they're just not flexible. Maybe genetics.
I think Aiden had another question.
That's what I was going to say too. That it seems like they might be pretty much physically fit and not pass the test, because pass all these areas and maybe not flexibility. So,
mm-hmm. No, that's true.
Yeah,
it's just
it's not really a matter of worry.
The way we're
really
built,
right? Exactly.
Any other questions, Mr. Eklund? Thank you very much, Mr. Andre, Mr. Zotovich, and I think Mr. Jones is back there. I will. Any other questions or comments on this item? And I think we have the outline that both Mark and Chris wanted to have further information. So we'll thank everybody for coming on that issue, and we'll move on to item number 7, which is another discussion item for support of Personnel Commission action on classification review regarding a particular job family, the clerical family.
Thank you. As you know, our Personnel Commission regularly, in fact, every 5 years, analyzes every position within the district, and currently just completed Gene Keller, who is the personnel analyst and does an incredible job, just concluded a study of some of the clerical job families, the school site clerical positions. And classification reviews generally yield very few changes, sometimes some changes in job duties or job qualifications. Occasionally, when they're coupled with a salary survey, we find that we need to make major adjustments to job families to become more competitive with like districts. And occasionally, we end up with the need to perhaps even reclassify positions because over time, we do this every 5 years with every position, significant changes either in the job itself or the way the job is structured at a particular site yields a need for a classification change. And that's what we have in front of you tonight, which really isn't your job. That's what our personnel commission does. But we will be bringing a recommendation to the personnel commission at their April 23rd meeting to reclassify an individual position, not a whole job family, at San Luis Obispo High School, where we have a secretary clerk who really is doing the duties under our job description of a receptionist, and that actually is a 2.5% differential in pay, and it is not the same at Morro Bay High School. It's kind of a larger population, different setting, different clerical allocations because of the size of the school, but it will be our recommendation that the individual that, or the individual position, not the person themselves, but the position will be reclassified from a secretary clerk to a receptionist. The cost to implement that is about $835 for the year, but we are asking the board for your support of that expenditure, and then the personnel commission will be dealing with the recommendation itself. And I'm available for any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Robinette? You know, I just wanted to mention briefly what an important role the personnel commission plays regarding our district's merit system, which doesn't get mentioned very often at this board meeting. But it's incredible in terms of the individual attention they give to CSEA, SEIU members, our classified employees, and the system works well when you can see things like this being addressed. And just very thankful I am personally, and I'm sure everyone else is, for the work that they do in these in this area. And thank you. And before we go on to, I don't think we have to make any motion. It's just a discussion item. There's no lack of support.
Great.
Thank you. They actually make the decision to implement this change. We just have to eventually pay for it. But before we go on to item number 8, there's been a request for a 5-minute break, which is probably very reasonable. So we'll take a break for 5 minutes and come back at 9:45. Okay, we're going to resume our board meeting with item number 8 regarding the planned study session for English learners, the English Learners Program. And I think that Dr. Valentine is going to present this.
Thank you. The board's requested a study session on the English Learner Program in our district. As we mentioned, we are in program improvement on the basis of the achievement of English learners in the area of English language arts. The protocol that the board is looking at was established by the board in a board retreat 2 years ago. And I would only put out for the board that as we go into the budget discussions that are starting in April and the employee recognition programs that are coming up in April and May and June, that we're going to be seeing pretty congested agendas between now and the end of the school year in June. Furthermore, we're required to revise our LEA plan based upon the corrective actions for No Child Left Behind, and that process is due in July to the California Department of Education. We are suggesting through all of this data that
for the study session.
I just
Adrian?
Have a question about what you just said, Dr. Valentine. It seems like the purpose of a study session might be to influence something like a plan that's developed.
It could be. You're right.
So I'm not sure there would be a purpose in having a study session at that time, exactly.
And that's a perfectly legitimate reason to have a study session earlier. We're suggesting that to really do the topic justice, we'd probably have to schedule a special board meeting to do it or put it onto a very busy agenda and dedicate whatever time we had in it. And we were just offering the suggestion that there might be some advantage to waiting.
Or maybe, you know, we don't. One of our questions might be, do we really actually want to have one?
Yeah, definitely.
In light of what you're saying, perhaps. I have a question, but I want to save mine for later, so go ahead, Chris.
I'm not sure how we want to do it. I think this is important enough of a topic on a lot of levels. We are a PI school. Whether you want to place a lot of stock on the test scores or not, what it indicates is, and I've had discussions with various members of the administration about this, that clearly there's more that we could be doing for our English language learners. And what is it that the district should be doing to support those folks? Making sure that our English language learners achieve the best they can is, it's a civil rights issue to me. And I think we owe it to students to make sure that, that we're doing right by them. And not that we're not trying real hard, but I wonder what we could be doing better. And so I'm wondering just a couple of thoughts and take it for what it is. For example, I'm curious about what are we doing now that's working? And then perhaps what are we doing that's not working? What can we do to make it better? What supports do we need to put in place? What supports do we have in place? What supports do we need to put in place to make sure that our EL students are achieving as much as they can? And then are there supports that the board needs to put into place?
I don't think this is something that we can hold off on, especially, I agree with Adrian, I mean, going into the budget and going into the LEA. So questions I might have is, what changes have we done since becoming PI? Adding just one of Chris's, which is, what are we doing now? Is there something special that we're doing now? And then there are programs that are out there in other districts that are extremely innovative and have won Golden Bell Awards and have done tremendous good. And I'm wondering if we can search those out without tying up, you know, staff's time forever and ever. So those are my three that I'd like to see.
And then also, I'll just mention, too, that I think it may be best to have this at a special session for a board meeting, only because the other meetings, as you indicated, are going to be packed with items. And I think if we're going to do a study session, if we all agree we are, that to kind of squeeze it in among a number of other things won't do its service or will take away from the other items. And the questions that I wrote up to consider, and this is what the administration can let us know if this works. Obviously, our strategic plan is to close the achievement gap, and the English language program is a very important part of closing the achievement gap. So my questions would be, what additional or different benchmarks can be developed for the English language program other than what are being used at this point for NCLB, because I think those are very straitjacketing in many ways, and I think that there may be other ways that we can judge improvement, even though it may not be something that will count towards our PI situation. But I think it's important for us to know what we're doing for our students that works, whether it shows up in that data or not. The other thing would be what different or additional assessments would enhance the evaluation or assistance that could be developed for the students. What else can we do in terms of assessing where the students are? I'd like to see an area covering questions regarding outreach to parents who are monolingual in terms of what we can direct through the students or we can direct directly to the parents. What can we do at the school sites to help parents feel more involved with their students' progress and the programs that are here? And I would also ask that that be incorporated into an evaluation of our adult ed program, because we also we have English learning classes there for parents, but maybe there are other classes that would benefit development. What could be done with staff development? Because I think we always need to look at how we are supporting our staff in terms of in-house support, professional development support, and new and courageous and innovative approaches, which is what Mark mentioned about what's working at other districts. Adrian.
Well, my question relates to our desire as educators to what full spectrum quality education, which includes art and music and all the areas of the curriculum. And my question is, when are we going to take seriously research that shows that students who study music improve their reading and math scores? And I see Mark scratching his head, you know, thinking, but if we're, I'm impressed with the RTI, but, I mean, you think about innovative thinking and thinking outside the box, maybe the students would benefit just as much by, let's say, learning to play an instrument during the school day, and that would make them, you know, help their cognitive development, self-esteem, interest in school, and all the factors that influence success in school to such an extent that it would, in fact, be an intervention that would help them progress through their standards.
You know, can
more
I ask
easily.
Just a question, just to clarify?
Yeah.
Just because we're creating questions or areas to cover, how would you put that into a question or an issue?
Well, this is my question. It goes along with your idea of what's working and what's not working, but what else could work that we're not considering, I guess?
Okay. And then Mark had a question.
Sorry,
Marilyn?
Marilyn, you haven't had a chance yet, please.
Well, a number of the things that have been mentioned are things that have occurred to me. The only thing I would add to it is, are we providing increased collaboration time for teachers working with English language learners since they are identified as a highly at-risk group? And if we're not, would we be able to provide increased collaboration? Thank you.
Mark?
I may have the acronym wrong. Is it DBAC? Is it?
DLAC.
I'm wondering if we could ask, and whether it's appropriate and whether the board would support us, there was money that was supposedly going to be set aside for adult learning. And I don't know whether we're tapping it or whether any districts ever tapped it. So maybe we need to look at that as well.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, areas, Catherine?
I would learn a great deal if we could cover the Pacheco approach to English-Spanish immersion and how that's taught at the lower levels and how the teachers there feel about the success of that program and whether there's an alternative approach that they would recommend taking.
Okay. Good questions. Any other items? Is that enough to begin the process?
I am hearing that we're going to have a special session, though, and we'll look for a date that works for everybody on the board.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think April 1st.
with that comment about the special session weighing on everybody's forehead, we'll move on to action consent items. And if members, board members, would indicate any of the items they wish to be pulled, I would appreciate if any. There's no necessity for this. Only if you want it. Item number 9, approval of certificated and classified items. Item number 10, certification of temporary athletic team coach qualifications and competencies. Item number 11, approval of secondary school schedules for the 2008-2009 school year. Item 12, acceptance of donations. Item 13, disposition of surplus property. Item 14, approval of furniture and equipment requests. Item 15, approval of purchase orders. 16, adoption of instructional material, K-6 science. Item 17, adoption of instructional materials, integrated science. 18, photovoltaic demonstration grant and CEQA determination regarding the Pacheco Elementary School project.
I move approval of items 9 through 18.
Is there a second to that, to Mr. Unger's motion?
I'll second that.
And
you want to add adjournment right on
there? I just want to mention as a comment before we take the vote, I wanted to thank Rita Delkiskamp and also Russ Rayburn for the presentation the last board meeting.
Were we going to consider what kind of minutes we want to make?
That's what I was thinking.
If we want to make any changes at all.
Do you want to phrase that? Or do you just want to just bring it up as a general?
Well, I was just throwing it out there. I don't want to change the way we do the minutes, but someone else might want to.
The only reason I brought it up at the beginning and then Mark can comment is I think if you are changing word by word, and I don't mean this for any particular person, but I think if you're going to go into the specifics of how it's recorded, then you have to have a full transcript of what's said so you don't have this constant discussion of what may or may not have been said, because nobody can remember. I can't anyway. I'm getting old. So I would just suggest that if we have an understanding on the minutes of what it is and what it isn't, or any other comment, that we could have that now so we can move forward. And Mark, did you have a comment on that?
I was just going
to... Thank you, Kim. I was just going to second Walter's request just so we could get it on the agenda.
Okay.
If we still need it.
And then Adrian had a comment also, and we'll come back.
Just regarding tonight, though, I was talking to Kim at break, and she's taking notes. Or what is she supposed to do for this? Do we have to have this as an agenda item, or can we just?
Well, I think if it's confusing, I think we should decide what the minutes are and what they aren't. And if that's the discussion item, then we have to discuss what they are and what they aren't. We can't expect them to be something they aren't if that's the standard that we're establishing, because the minutes are great, but. So is it an agenda item? What are the minutes? What are they and what aren't they? Okay.
We can't just decide to let her go ahead and
do it the way she's been doing it. We can't decide that right now.
Well, I'm thinking that we're here because I think there's effort by everybody to kind of change the way the minutes are taken, and there's a conversation, and it's almost a conversation in an empty room in a way, because not all of us are remembering what it was said. And so I think it's a matter of, do we want the personal remarks about individual comments, or do we want just the essence of the motion? I'm fine. I think we spend time trying to rewrite the minutes. That's the only point. What's their purpose? Is it to show specific comments? Do we need to bring letters from each of our board members of what we really want said?
Well, do you really think we actually need an agenda item? I mean, it sounds like Catherine wants to keep it the way it is. Mark does, right? No? Walter does.
Actually, I'd like to go an action set of minutes, but I'm a little confused as how board reports would become
a report period, and however you would like the minutes to reflect the meeting, I will do. But those are areas where there wasn't an action taken, and I need to figure out how detailed you want them to be.
Well, you know, my sense is that if somebody said yes and it's no that's reported, then you can change the no to the yes. If somebody's name is misspelled, you can correct the spelling of the name. It's just a matter of what you expect in those notes, in those minutes.
It seems to me that we'll spend a lot less time in totality revising and discussing minutes if we can come to a collective understanding of the board of what we want to accomplish with our minutes. And I don't think we're there.
And Marilyn had a comment.
Well, I think I've only once in 5 years asked for a correction to the minutes, and that was when there was a factual inaccuracy as to, I think, the date of something or the spelling of something. But for me, the minutes really do serve to refresh my memory as to what went on, because over 2 weeks' time, truthfully, I can't remember all that went on. The minutes, as I've come to know them, are really beneficial for me. But we've had issues in the past and discussions about wordsmithing the minutes, and if it's going to be a persistent problem, then maybe we do need to make some kind of a change.
Adrian?
I think you're all referring to me on this issue, and I think it, maybe we can have an agenda item, but I don't think it's wordsmithing as much as make sure of focus. So, and I think that I have taken that into consideration, and there's a perception that it happens when you haven't noticed a change, but I think the minutes do serve a purpose the way they are, and I think Kim does a superb job, which I've always asserted, on the way she does it. And we heard from the teachers that read that they...
we heard from the president of the CTA who said that.
Well, actually, the point I wanted to raise, was that I'd like to talk with some teachers and just see how much they do. I can imagine that the commendations that are made here by the board members are important to them, and to hear some of the discussion that goes on about why decisions are made may be important to them. Personally, I'd like to ask those questions.
Remarks that Mr. Miller has made attributed to me and vice versa. We always want to correct that. I think we have a pretty good example. Marilyn wants the minutes to be a memory aid. Catherine wants them, or thinks they are, a communication device to district employees. I don't believe that they're either one of those things, but maybe that's why we need to talk about it.
And I second Mr. Millar's motion that it come on the agenda so we can put it on there. And there's a second by Mr. Buckman, who's taken my thunder. And now that that's been resolved, are there any other advance agenda items? And seeing none, I think we're now ready to adjourn. Thank you.